This is the Medicast, February 19th, 2007.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the Medicast, episode 54. I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I want to thank all of you for picking up this podcast. For those of you that are brand new listeners, welcome to the show, and stick around. Check out a few episodes, check out the website at medicast.com, and get a feel for what the Medicast community is all about. And of course, for all of you long-term listeners, I want to thank you for sticking around and listening to the show, and for contributing all of the things that you do contribute to the show. As that said, I'd like to comment on a few things I've picked up over at the listener survey. I've been starting to get some data back from that survey, and it's really helping me to make the Medicast a better podcast for you. So if you're interested in filling out the survey, go on over to the Medicast site. In the show notes, you'll see a link for filling out the survey for the podcast. It takes about 5 minutes, and it helps me find out a little bit about who you are and what you'd like to see in the show. It gives you an opportunity to comment there. One of the things you commented on a couple of times was that I get into the meat of the show a little bit faster. And I'll try to do that and make an effort to move on into things as I go. I'm going to move right on into some listener email and comments I got this week. Quite a few came in, both by email and on the comment section of the website. If you head on over to medicast.com on the blog there, you'll see each of the posts at the bottom of the post has a place where you can leave a comment. You click the comment link, and it'll give you an opportunity to leave a comment on the site there. The first time you leave a comment, I have to approve it just to make sure you're not spamming the show. But then once you get approved, you can go ahead and leave comments anytime you feel like it. Listener Jennifer left a comment based on her experiences dealing with patients who are DNR patients and what it means to give palliative care to patients that have requested only DNR at the BLS level. In other words, they don't want any ALS interventions and what that means. So you can check out the posting I put up on palliative care and Jennifer's comments, as well as some comments from long-term contributor Chris over there as well. I also got a comment in from listener Andy out in California, and he was just sharing with me that he considers his family a public safety family. Both he and his wife Pam have commented to the show before, and both he and his wife are both paramedics, and his oldest daughter is getting involved in their Fire Explorers program, and he's really excited about his other children becoming involved in the public safety sector. And, you know, I commented back to Andy, and I'll share this with you. I don't think that, you know, this is unusual. We are a group of people who really share our values and our desire to be helpful in our communities with our families and our children. And that impact spreads out and goes down through the generations. There are families that are historically police families. There are families that are historically firefighters' families. And, you know, that's no different for us in EMS either. So I was excited to see his comment back, and I completely agree, Andy. It's really exciting when you see your kids feel strongly enough to want to follow in your footsteps in that way. Listener Daniel had commented before about collegiate-level EMS services made up of students, and he wanted to let me know about the National Collegiate Emergency Medical Services Foundation holding their annual conference on the 23rd through the 25th of February. That's this coming weekend in Baltimore. So, Daniel, I'm not going to be able to get down there because of some prior commitments, but I hope you guys have a great time and enjoy your presentations. And shoot me a line and let me know how the conference went and on your impressions on it. Maybe I can call you up and interview you about that. Anybody else who'd be interested in going, give me an email and I will go ahead and shoot you a link about that conference. at podmedic@mac.com, or you can search for the National Collegiate Emergency Medical Services Foundation Conference. Finally, listener William shot me a line and wanted to thank me for doing the show. He's a first responder in Tennessee and is an aspiring paramedic himself. So, William and everybody else out there that's in that same position, I always love to hear from you. And if there's anything that you want me to cover, shoot me an email or drop me a line at the voicemail line. You can reach me by email at podmedic@mac.com. And you can reach me by voicemail at the new voicemail line. You can call me at 941-306-3342. That's 941-30-MEDIC. And you can leave me a message there, and I will listen to it. And if you want me to get back to you, drop me an email. Leave me your email at the end of the message, and I will make sure I clip it out if I include it in the show. But that way I can get back to you. Okay, that's done. Let's jump right on into this week's news. I'm sure a lot of you have been looking at the news items on the Trolley Square shooting out in Utah, where the young gentleman went into the shopping mall and began shooting at people in the middle of Salt Lake City's Trolley Square shopping mall there. And these things always bring to mind, for me, myself reviewing what I would do in a situation where I have severe gunshot victims, review my triage protocols, review what I would do for different types of gunshot wounds, review what I would do to handle any kind of penetrating injury like this, as well as reviewing the importance of scene safety and those kind of items. So I found an article. There's just a brief mention of a paramedic, but it has to do with a gentleman who thought he was going to die. He'd been shot four times, and he thought he was going to die, and then a paramedic got to him and uttered what he called the best words he had ever heard: "You're going to be all right." And, you know, this just brings home to me what we mean to our public, what we mean to the people we serve. Sometimes we really don't get it. Sometimes I think we become a little, I don't know, immune to that sense of what people look at and see when they see us coming in to help them out with a problem. Yeah, I know there's some people who take advantage of that situation, but by and large, most people call us because they really need some help. And we may not perceive it as a great deal of help, but we have to remember that our version of emergency and someone else's version of an emergency are completely different. And we may understand some things that they don't medically, and they may really think that something serious is going on. In this situation, it certainly was, but a paramedic got there and helped this person to survive, and he's going to pull through. And it's probably due to the treatment of that paramedic and his crew on the scene, doing the things he needed to do right away to stabilize this patient so that he could get the definitive treatment that he needed. Well, the next item I came across has some really neat information that is going to be made available to, hopefully, some of our listeners. A select group of Daytona Beach Community College paramedic, nursing, and respiratory students are going to be going in and working as doctors, nurses, and respiratory therapists and paramedics while they team up with a medical simulation conference demonstration that is going to be happening near their location. And this just sounds very exciting. Hundreds of medical and educational experts are going to be looking on while the students will discover the patient, a life-size, living, breathing human patient simulator produced by a company called METI. They have hosted this particular part of this conference that will be allowing these students to get in there and work with these simulators and work as the on-scene medical providers for this simulated patient. So I'm really interested to hear how this goes. If you're listening to the show and are a member of the group that was selected to participate in this conference or know someone who is, please get back to me, and I'd like to maybe talk with you and share your experience with that simulator with the rest of the listeners, because this is an opportunity that a lot of us may not get to have. These human patient simulators are really neat. If you've ever seen one, they breathe, they have, you know, their chest rises and falls, they have venous access, they have airway access, they present just like a real patient, and it's a real neat opportunity for anybody that gets a chance to actually interact with them. So you think your job is rough? Well, how would you like to be an ambulance provider in the city of Baghdad? I found a great article that talks about ambulance drivers and ambulance providers in the city of Baghdad. And just basically, it opens up with saying that driving an ambulance in Iraq is a labor of love. They risk carjackings, bombs, sniper fire, all to save people's lives. And before the invasion, there were about 80 ambulances in the city of Baghdad. Now, thanks to programs that are bringing more materials into that country, they have more than 400 ambulances in the city of Baghdad. And while insurgents often hijack ambulances to try to get them to deliver bombs to a site that's already had a bombing, they still make an effort to get out there and get the job done. Since the beginning of the war, 25 ambulance drivers have been killed and 19 severely injured while on duty, but a new fleet of ambulances that are much faster and more nimble are coming on the way, and they're excited about it because it's going to help them escape, if you can believe thinking about that. You know, talk about scene safety, you know, when you feel like you need to get out of there because you're taking on sniper fire. One of the providers related a story about how he had an 18-month-old boy shot through the neck. He was trying to get him to a vascular surgeon, but the vascular surgeon people at that hospital couldn't get good vascular access to start an IV. He took the boy to a pediatric hospital to get IV started and then back to the hospital with the vascular surgeon. Just, talk about finding definitive care and knowing your hospitals. It's a great read. I find articles like this periodically, and I think it's important for us to know a little bit about what other providers are going through in other areas of the world. They don't have access to all of the materials and all of the supplies that we have access to, and yet they still manage to get the job done. So kudos to the drivers and providers of the ambulances in Iraq and in the city of Baghdad. Speaking of combat medicine and the advances and techniques that are available there, the FDA has fast-tracked a new medical device that was designed specifically for the U.S. military, and it's using a new fast-track program requested by the military in order to get special devices to treat combat wounds more effectively and efficiently in the field to service faster. You know, the military is bound by using FDA-approved products just like we are, and so this has been a process that they've tried to streamline in order to do things like save our soldiers in the field, save limbs, save more serious injuries from occurring because of lack of definitive treatment where they are. This device has actually come about to actually salvage limbs that might have otherwise been amputated because of loss of vascular access to the lower part of the extremity, the distal part of the soon-to-be amputated limb. What has happened is it's a vascular device that works by connecting the ends of severed blood vessels, providing a bridge or a shunt around the damaged area and restoring blood flow to the injured limb. It can be implanted on the battlefield or other remote areas to bypass damaged blood vessels and temporarily maintain blood flow to the injured limb until they can be transported to a surgical facility. 6% of the 14,000 soldiers injured in Iraq between March 2003 and August 2005, an equivalent to 28 soldiers a month, had an arm or leg amputated. So this device is going to make a huge difference, perhaps saving as many as one or two soldiers a day. And so I think this is exciting stuff because As we know, devices like this and new medical advances like this that come up during wartime often find their way into our kits and the streets as civilian ambulance providers. And so I'm always excited when I see things like this come along, because it may not be something all of us carry, but you may have it on a chase vehicle or a supervisor's vehicle, so that if you get a gunshot victim or you have a victim of an explosion or a severe trauma, that device can be brought into the scene to help stabilize patients before they get to the hospital. So I think it's really exciting. Finally, a story I found cropped up that caught my eye, having to do with the child flu deaths of school-aged children and the effect it's having on their communities and their school systems. In several states around the country, some schools have closed or have restricted some of their students from coming back because of widespread flu symptoms rampant among those children. In fact, as many as 9 children around the country have died from flu, and 6 other child deaths have been tentatively linked to the flu since February 3rd. There's just been a recent upsurge in the number of flu deaths. Last year, 47 children under the age of 18 died from influenza, and in 2003-2004 flu season, the worst in recent memory, the number of children that died was 153. And this is really causing some problems. You know, how many kids are out from school? How many are having the flu? How many of those flu victims are having severe flu symptoms and maybe really at risk for dying from having the flu? You know, for some kids, it's a respiratory illness and it resolves on its own rather quickly with relatively minor symptoms. But in others, it can develop into much more serious problems. So, and I don't know what's going on in your community, but you might want to check in with your local ER, check with your local health department, find out exactly what they've seen in the way of flu problems in your community among the elderly and among the very young, and find out what they're seeing. What kind of symptoms are they running into? What kind of treatments are they recommending? These are all things that you can do to make sure that when you have this problem, you don't run into this in your community and not be prepared for it. And this kind of is what led me to jump in with influenza as our tip and trick of the week. And the reason I did that is because it's something that, you know, we see a lot this time of year. We're in the middle of the flu season. And what exactly are we looking for? How can we identify patients that are in more severe symptoms than others? And maybe by starting treatment in the field, we may be able to stave off some of the more serious problems and get them to the hospital a little bit faster by recognizing what we're seeing. The influenza virus is a virus that's spread from person to person, primarily by droplet transmission. So when someone coughs or sneezes and is close enough to you for those droplets to carry, they can be breathed in through you, or they land on your skin and then you touch your mucous membranes, either rub your eye or pick your nose or, you know, eat something that you haven't washed your hands before handling your food, all these things. I mean, you know, I hate to be silly about it, but it really is that simple. How often do you touch your face, your mouth, your nose, your eyes with your hands after, you know, you've touched something else? And so it's really important that we be careful about hand washing and careful about not getting too close to people that we suspect have a respiratory infection. Typically, the incubation period is about 1 to 4 days with an average of 4 days. And what this means is that adults can be infectious for a day before their symptoms even show up, to approximately maybe 5 or 6 days afterwards. Children can even carry infectious and be infectious for as many as 10 or more days after the onset of symptoms. So it's important for us to be aware of the fact that we may have contagious patients that we're carrying around with us. Also, people that have an immune system that is compromised can be shedding the virus in an infectious state for up to weeks or months because their immune system is not suppressing and killing the virus. And so it's something that we really need to be aware of when you're taking your histories to find out what else is going on. Now, when influenza crops up and is uncomplicated, it is usually characterized by onset of respiratory signs and symptoms, general respiratory signs and symptoms, and general systemic signs and symptoms, like fever, headache, malaise, a non-productive cough, sore throat, runny nose, you know, just general things. In children, you may see an ear infection. Nausea and vomiting may also be reported. So you just need to kind of see what's going on in these things. Usually these things will resolve, like most viruses, within 3 to 7 days for most people. The cough and the general feeling of crappiness might last for up to 2 weeks or more, but generally the major symptoms resolve within, 7 days or so. But some people, it can, influenza, because of its effect on the body and its immune system, can cause problems with existing medical problems, underlying medical conditions, underlying respiratory illnesses like asthma, pulmonary or cardiac disease, and other problems. And this can cause the lungs to be unable to clear infected fluid or take care of itself. It might suppress the immune system. And so you can end up with patients that get secondary infections like bacterial pneumonias. Younger children may have initial symptoms that even look like they're septic because they have high fevers, febrile seizures, and it turns out to have been an influenza viral infection and not a bacterial septic infection. So we need to kind of be aware of these things and kind of get a whole picture. Has anyone else in the family been sick? Have they been around anyone else that's been sick? You know, you can find out based on someone else's general symptoms that, well, you know what? Mom had a virus and mom seemed to have had like a really bad respiratory virus. And now the kid's sick. It may look like sepsis and you're going to need to treat the symptoms as such, but you need to pass this history information on so that the doctors are able to care properly for the patient and can plan for not a septic illness, but a viral illness. Patients that we might encounter that require hospitalization with suspected flu symptoms include the very old and the very young. Some people in the middle there might be at increased risk for complications. Children and adolescents who are receiving aspirin therapy might be at risk for experiencing RISE syndrome after an influenza virus infection. Also, pregnant women, adults and children who have chronic disorders of the respiratory tract or pulmonary and cardiovascular symptoms, including those with asthma and bronchitis. Adults and children who have required regular medical follow-up or hospitalization because of metabolic diseases like diabetes, include also renal dysfunction and immunodeficiency or other immunocompromised problems like those with HIV virus. Adults and children who have any condition that may compromise their respiratory function, such as seizure disorders, spinal cord injuries, or neuromuscular disorders. And also the residents of nursing homes and chronic care facilities that house persons who have chronic medical conditions. It's important for us to get these people to the hospital and get them seen by definitive care so that they can be treated there. We need to treat the symptoms we see. We may have patients who are dehydrated, so it's important for us to get fluids on board as needed. We need to get the patient oxygenated. We need to verify what their oxygen status is and their respiratory status is. If you have access to capnography via the nasal cannula type of capnography device, the pass-by or blow-by capnography that enables you to verify some of the respiratory status, you may be able to assist in some of your treatments and know of the effectiveness of their gas exchange in their lungs. All of these things are just things you need to be aware of. Again, be prepared to treat febrile seizures. But remember, seizures are not necessarily a life-threatening problem. If the patient becomes rapidly goes back into a postictal state, and you can supply them with oxygen, that momentary lapse of apnea that happens when someone has a seizure is not going to cause a problem. We don't want to just jump on board and start giving out Valium or other benzos and snowing this patient so that we can't effectively treat them. Remember, we would depress their respiratory status by giving them these medications as well. So we want to be aware that a febrile seizure is just that. It probably will resolve on its own. We're not talking about status epilepticus here. We're talking about just a febrile seizure. So be prepared to understand what that means and treat accordingly. And of course, get them to the proper hospital. Consult with your medical command. Find out if the patient is a pediatric patient, whether it's best to go to the local community hospital, or maybe it's time to drive a little bit farther and take them to a pediatric specialty center where they can get some better long-term care if this is indeed an exacerbated or more complicated case of influenza. The also important thing to remember is to protect yourself and to protect your unit. When you have a suspected influenza patient or a patient with a respiratory illness where you're going to have droplet transmission, they're coughing or they're breathing in your ambulance, you need to make sure you're cleaning your unit, because all you're going to do is transmit that virus to the next person that comes along. You're going to give it to yourself, you're going to take it home to your families, or you're going to get it to your next patient. So it's important to make sure you wipe down your surfaces with your cleaning materials and make sure your unit and your materials and your supplies and equipment are all cleaned off for the next patient. All of these things, along with hand washing, will all help stop the spread of the influenza virus to more people. So that's a little bit on the influenza virus. You can check out a link in the show notes to the CDC site on influenza, and you can check out many of their links and materials that they have available there on the virus and what's going on to treat it around the country. So we've talked about the influenza virus. How many of you have gotten your flu vaccine this year? Well, you know, I know it's a little late. We probably should have covered this back in October or November, but it's not too late to get the flu vaccine if you think you're going to need it. And if you're listening to this show, the chances are pretty good that you probably fall into the group that should probably have a flu vaccine. So this week's Med of the Week is going to be looking at the influenza vaccine. Information for you, for your families, and for your patients. The single best way to fight the influenza virus is to get vaccinated each year. There are two types of vaccine. There is a flu shot. It's an inactivated vaccine. It contains a killed version of the virus, a dead version of the virus. It's given with a needle, usually in the arm, and it's approved for use in people from the age of 6 months and older, including healthy people and people with chronic medical conditions. There's also a nasal spray flu vaccine. It's a spray. It's made of a live, weakened flu virus. It doesn't cause the flu. It's called a live, attenuated influenza vaccine. And it's approved for use in healthy people from 5 years old to 49 years of age. Each vaccine contains three different viruses. And this is done every year. The CDC and other agencies, the World Health Organization, go out there and through their studies figure out which influenza version of the virus is coming around this year. And they use that to figure out which of them are going to be the most prevalent and the most needed to be vaccinated against. And then they go ahead and create the vaccine based on that information. This is, you know, big science stuff, and they go out there and they do that. There's information you can find over at the CDC site that explain a little bit more about it. But the virus and the vaccine is not the same every year. So that's why you need to get continuous flu vaccines year after year after year, because the virus changes and it's a different virus at different times. About 2 weeks after your vaccination, antibodies that provide protection against the influenza virus will develop in your body. Normally, it's time to get vaccinated in October or November, which is before the flu season starts, but you can still be vaccinated in December or even later. Flu season begins as early as October and may last as long as May. If you think or wonder if you should get vaccinated, in general, anyone who wants to reduce their chances of getting the flu can get vaccinated, but there is a certain group of people who should get vaccinated every year. First of all, people who are at high risk for complications from the flu, younger children, pregnant women, people 50 years of age or older, anyone with certain chronic medical conditions, especially pulmonary and cardiac medical conditions, and anyone who lives in a nursing home or long-term care facility, regardless of your age, needs to look at getting the flu vaccine. The second group of people that need to be wary of this and get the flu vaccine are any of those who live with or care for those at high risk. So anybody that's around the group above probably needs to have the flu vaccine. Household contacts and healthcare workers. So you daycare providers, yes. Nurses, yes. Doctors, yes. EMTs and paramedics, definitely. Anybody that goes into healthcare facilities or deals with a large number of patients probably would benefit greatly from getting the vaccine. Remember, the spray version of the vaccine is only for people between the ages of 5 and 49 years of age and are in the low-risk group. They don't have any medical complications, and so they can better handle the live attenuated virus that's in the spray version. There are some people who should not be vaccinated. So that's important. This is a contraindication for vaccinations. And this is why you want to check with your doctor. These include people who have had a severe allergy to chicken eggs, people who have had a severe reaction to past vaccinations of the flu vaccine, people who have developed Guillain-Barré syndrome within 6 weeks of getting a previous influenza vaccine shot, using a vaccine that is not approved for use in your group. So you don't want to get the nasal vaccine if you're in a high-risk group, and you don't want to give it to children less than 6 months of age. Hopefully, these children have developed some of the resistance factors that they've gotten from their mothers at birth, and some of these parental immunizations still carry on at this age. Also, people who should not be vaccinated or those who have a moderate or severe illness with a fever shouldn't get their vaccine until their illness has gone away and their symptoms have lessened. Just if you're sick, you need to wait and get your vaccine maybe a week later or something. The ability of the flu vaccine to protect somebody depends on your age and your general health status. And also the similarity between the virus you actually get and the version that the vaccine is there to protect you against. Remember, the influenza viruses present with many, many different viruses. The vaccine covers the ones that they greatly suspect to be present in the majority of patients, but you may still get a version of the influenza virus that infects you that is not covered by the vaccine. There are some side effects from the vaccine shot. If you get a flu shot, you may get some soreness or redness or swelling in the area where the shot was given. And again, this is usually in the arm. You may also get a low-grade fever. If any of these problems occur, they usually occur soon after you get the shot and last for just a couple of days. If you get the live attenuated virus in the nasal spray, you may get a runny nose, experience short duration headache, vomiting, muscle aches and fever. In adults, you may also get a sore throat or a cough. There's a lot of information about the vaccine available over at the CDC site. So you can go on over and check the link in the show notes at medicast.com, or you can head on over to the CDC site at www.cdc.gov. And you can search there for flu and flu vaccine, and you'll get a whole ton of information. The CDC really stays on top of this, as they should, And it's a great resource for you as medical providers to head on over there and find out more about it. So this covers the Med of the Week, kind of looking at the flu vaccine, and you can answer some questions for your patients as well as yourself and your families about who should and shouldn't get the flu vaccine. But I urge everybody that's a medical provider of any kind, you'll protect yourself, you'll protect your families, and you'll be able to protect your other patients when you come in contact with the influenza virus. And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. First of all, I want to thank everybody for listening to the show. I also want to let everybody know that I sent out the prizes from last week's giveaway of the Vein Light, as well as a CD from the band In Caves from listener Zach. They sent us the CDs in from his band. And also a MedicCast hat that I sent out to a listener. And all of those lucky listeners are subscribers to the MedicCast newsletter. You can head on over to the website, and in the upper right-hand corner, you'll see a link that says Free MedicCast Newsletter Here. Go ahead and click on that link, and it'll give you a little web form to fill out. Fill that out, and you'll sign up for the MedicCast newsletter. Every week, I'll send out a email to you via the newsletter that'll have links to all the information in the show notes, links to the show notes entry page, so you can go ahead and check that out at the MedicCast site, as well as a special tip and trick of the week that's available only for newsletter subscribers. Also, once a month, newsletter subscribers will get a separate newsletter with some extra tips and tricks just for newsletter subscribers there. And it's just a little something I've put together so that those of you that have access to the newsletter can go ahead and get some extra information from me directly. So head on over to the MedicCast and subscribe for the MedicCast newsletter right now. And I think you'll be happy with the information you get. I don't share your email address with anybody, and I don't spam anybody with that information. It's just a way for me to keep better in touch with you, the listeners of the MedicCast. Remember, you can always catch me with comments, suggestions, and yes, corrections of anything that I've talked about here in the show or on the website. You can reach me by email at podmedic@mac.com. You can also reach me at the voicemail line at 941-306-3342. That's 941-30-MEDIC. Finally, you can comment on the site. Remember to leave your comments there. There's been a lot of great comments left by several listeners over at the MedicCast site, and your comments are welcome too. So head on over there and leave your comments on the MedicCast site. Finally, and probably most importantly, you can share the MedicCast with other providers. Share the show with them. Let other people know about the MedicCast and the information that you get from the show. And share with them that they don't need an iPod to listen to the MedicCast. You can listen to the MedicCast right on your computer in any web browser. And a lot of cell phones now have access to podcasts. If you have a Nokia cell phone, you can check out the information from the Nokia site. You can actually access Blueberry podcasts like the MedicCast directly from the Nokia podcast directory on selected Nokia phones. So check out that option as well and share the MedicCast with people you know. I will wrap up as I always do with some excellent PodSafe music from the PodSafe Music Network this week. This week, the PodSafe Music Network at music.podshow.com has provided me with a great song by blues artist Billy Jones. And since it is the weekend after Valentine's Day, I thought it would be appropriate to play a song called Da Love Doctor. So you can check this out over at the PodSafe Music Network. And if you like this music and are interested in purchasing it, there's a link in the show notes that'll take you directly to the iTunes Music Store download for this particular song. And you can purchase it over there if you're so inclined. Remember that there's a link for the iTunes store for a lot of the music that I play here on the MedicCast. So if you heard a song in the past, you can click that link in the show notes as well and check out a list of all of the music that I've played that's available for download at the iTunes store. I guess that's it. Until next week, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Scene Safety, BSI.
they call me the love doctor, 'cause I got patients all over town. Yeah, they call me the love doctor, 'cause I got a women's all over town. You guarantee satisfaction when the love doctor make his round. You say your husband is so contrary, and your love life going down the drain. You say he changed once y'all got married, and your relationship is in a strain. You just call on your love doctor to make love like a natural man. Got patients all over town. Yeah, they call me the love doctor, 'cause I got a women's all over town. You guarantee satisfaction when the love doctor make it round.